Today on New Horizons, Boise State University earthquake seismologist Jim Zulwick.
You can have a very large earthquake that can do little damage if things have been designed right. Conversely, though, you can have an earthquake that comes along and surprises everybody because it causes much more violent motion than was expected. We don't have a very good handle on where active faults are in Idaho at this point. We know that there's a lot of them, but the kind of information that they really need to make intelligent siting decisions is not available. We have no shortage in the Idaho area of fractures and faults that water can actually migrate toward the surface. The question more seems whether or not we can concentrate these resources or not.
I'm John Gardner, Associate Vice President for Energy Research, Policy, and Campus Sustainability at Boise State University, filling in for President Bob Kustra. Welcome to New Horizons. Jim Zulwick is a Boise State earthquake seismologist and an adjunct faculty member in the Division of Extended Studies here at Boise State. In addition to fieldwork in the United States, he has traveled to many parts of the world, including the Arctic, North Africa, New Guinea, the Middle East, Central and South America, and India. His adventures have included being trapped in the crater at Mount St. Helens just before an eruption, being charged by polar bears, and being tear gassed in Ecuador. Jim has established a network of 20 seismograph stations in eastern Oregon and central and western Idaho to monitor the many small earthquakes that occur within about 150 miles of Boise. And he has also used seismic activity to identify potential sources of geothermal energy. Other major research topics include understanding how large earthquakes are caused at places where the tectonic plates meet, and why very large earthquakes, like the India earthquake in 2001, occur in the interior of plates. An interview with Jim was recently featured on the History Channel's program, Mega Disasters. Jim Zulwick, welcome to New Horizons.
Thank you, John.
Well, let's start by talking about that adventure we just alluded to at Mount St. Helens. Tell us what you were doing there and what happened, and just how close were you to the eruption?
Well, I was... At the time, I was operating the seismograph network at Mount St. Helens, and we knew an eruption was coming, but just before the eruption, the station inside the crater of Mount St. Helens quit. We really wanted data from that station very badly, and so without knowing how much time we had before the eruption, we got a helicopter and went in. The weather was terrible, and after we were left off, the helicopter couldn't come and get us again. So we were in there for probably 6 or 7 hours at least. There were rock falls coming off the crater walls. We couldn't see more than 3 or 4 feet, and it was pretty eerie. Finally, it opened up a little bit, and the helicopter could get us. But the eruption occurred the next day.
That's a little too close for comfort, I suppose.
I think we probably would have been in mortal danger where we were.
So. I got to ask, you got the station running. Was the data worth it? Did you get good data out of it?
Oh, yes, we did. We got excellent data for the eruption. Whether it's worth it in the broader sense, it's hard to say now, but it seemed like the thing to do.
Let's not look past, look forward. Well, let's talk a little bit about earthquakes and volcanoes and how they're different, how they're similar. What exactly causes an earthquake?
Most earthquakes are caused by the rock slippage on either side of a fracture known as a fault. And stress will build up along these fault lines until it's too strong for the rocks to absorb, and then you have a sudden slip, which is an earthquake. Earthquakes can be all sizes. You can have little tiny ones, you can have great big ones, and faults can be of all sizes as well.
But that's different than a volcano. What's a volcano?
Well, a volcano is usually some sort of plumbing system where the lava or magma can actually rise to the surface in some manner. On the other hand, this actually fractures a lot of rock as it comes up because basically it's partially fluid, it's under pressure, it's getting into little fractures in the rock and stuff like that. And so one of the best tools we have for predicting volcanic eruptions is also the increase in rate of earthquake activity, you know, as it builds up.
And when we hear about earthquakes reported, there's always a number associated with it, a magnitude on the Richter scale. Tell us about how that's measured. What does that mean?
Well, it's kind of an historical thing because it's how big the amplitude of the earthquake should have been on an old type of seismometer that we don't use anymore. So it basically is some way of just simply quantifying how large it should be on a seismogram at a certain distance. So a magnitude 5 at a distance of 100 kilometers or 60 miles from an earthquake should have an amplitude of approximately 100 millimeters on one of these records. So we we've converted that all to digital stuff nowadays, and it's completely changed. What it means in terms of energy has been a subject of big research for a long time, but probably every time you go up a magnitude unit, go from magnitude 6 to 7, you're going up somewhere by a factor of 30 to 50 in the amount of energy that it takes. Mm.
I always heard it was a factor of 10, so that's...
Yeah, it takes a 30 to 50 times as much energy to move the ground 10 times as much.
Oh, okay, so the factor of 10 is related to how much it's moving.
Right.
30 to 50 is how much energy, which is really what's important when you're talking about damage to structures. And
also, if you're comparing earthquakes, for instance, if you're comparing a magnitude 6 to a magnitude 7, you need 30 to 50 magnitude 6s to equal a magnitude 7.
So what's the largest magnitude ever recorded for earthquakes?
The largest earthquake we know about was about magnitude 9.5. That was the Chilean earthquake of 1960. And the earthquake in Sumatra 3 years ago now was a magnitude 9.3. Those are big earthquakes. It's been predicted that a 10.6 would split the earth in half.
Wow. So we're getting close.
I think we've got a long way to go yet.
So the most recent earthquake we've heard about, it was over in China. We had an 8.0 earthquake. What caused that quake? What do you know about it? Can you give us any background on that?
China is kind of a mishmash of different plates colliding with each other. And this is a kind of earthquake that you would normally expect when two plates are colliding very strongly with each other, or if the interior of a plate is buckling. So this type of earthquake pushes one side of the earth up against gravity, and is one of the reasons why they tend to be so destructive, because it takes even more energy to actually push the earth upward against gravity. And so this is a plate interior earthquake, and is kind of similar, we think, to what we would have if we had earthquakes in the middle of the United States. At New Madrid, Missouri in 1811 and 12, we had four earthquakes, magnitude 8 to 8.6. The earthquake I studied in India was about a magnitude 8, and it was also in a plate interior. Not very much is understood about how these things happen, and so this Chinese earthquake is very interesting, not only because of the damage it caused, but also because just how it occurred.
So is the damage it caused, it sounds like you're saying it's because it was this kind of earthquake. Was it also related to the kinds of structures that were around there as well? Or?
These two kinds of things interact, John. Basically, you can have a very large earthquake that can do little damage if things have been designed right. And conversely, though, you can have an earthquake that comes along and surprises everybody because it causes much more violent motion than was expected. I think that there's a combination of both of these things that went on in the Chinese earthquake.
Hmm. Well, turning our attention to a little more locally in Idaho, what I think a lot of people would be interested to know, what do you think are the dangers for earthquake or potential for dangerous earthquakes here in the Boise area?
Well, according to several federal assessments, Idaho is the fifth most seismically active state in the country. And so we certainly expect that we're going to have big earthquakes in Idaho. And historically, we have had some. In Boise, it's been a little bit different because there are not a whole lot of instrumentally recorded earthquakes around Boise. They do occur once in a while. But over the last 10 years, I and some of my colleagues have actually located some faults that are close to Boise. And even though they seem to be silent with these little earthquakes, they're clear geologic evidence that they've been active in relatively recent times. So we think that the potential for earthquakes in Boise, all things considered, I think you could have a fairly serious earthquake here about every 900 years. I think you can have one that's not quite so serious about every 600 to 700 years.
So if we get unlucky and one of those happens around now, 6 miles upstream from us is a very large dam holding back an awful lot of water. And we know from China that earthquakes and rivers interact in unfortunate ways. What do you think are the issues related with the Lucky Peak? Do you think that's a potential problem?
I've had a lot of questions on this over the years. It seems to be one of Boiseans' greatest concerns. I personally think that Lucky Peak is extremely well constructed, and the likelihood of it rupturing during an earthquake, I think, is pretty low. I would be a bit more concerned about the possibility that if it happened at high pool levels, or if you had landslides that occurred from the mountains around it, that you could actually get possibly some overtopping of the reservoir. But I feel very little concern for the structural integrity of the dam. I think the structural integrity of the dam is very good. These other possibilities are more remote. Some of these things did happen in China, but it took an extremely large earthquake to do it, larger than I think we would have around here.
So moving a little further upstream, what about Arrow Rock Dam?
Well, Arrow Rock Dam, one of the first large engineering structures that the Bureau of Reclamation built, 1916, the tallest dam in the world when it was built.
No kidding.
Know that. It's the Bureau of Reclamation, ever since the Teton Dam disaster in 1976, has been very, very careful to reevaluate the structural integrity of all their dams. Although Arrow Rock is quite old, its integrity is good. Still, I would be a little more hesitant to want to test it than I would Lucky Peak. But I don't really expect that there would be any problems under any reasonable earthquake that we could expect to happen.
Well, that's comforting. Good to know. A little bit more about the history of Idaho. We found that two of the worst earthquakes in the contiguous United States in the last 30 years have occurred in Idaho. Can you tell me about those a little bit?
Well, one of them actually occurred right on our border, and the fault that caused it goes into Idaho, so I still claim it as an Idaho earthquake. But that was the 1959 earthquake at Yellowstone, and that was a magnitude 7.5 earthquake, and is one of the biggest earthquakes in the interior of the western United States that there actually has occurred. And then there's the 7.3 magnitude Bora Peak earthquake in 1983. It occurred up near Challis and killed two people up at Challis. These two earthquakes are important earthquakes, both because they cause casualties, but also they show the type of earthquake that you can actually expect in the Idaho region. There's been a lot of magnitude sixes in Idaho. We don't hear much about those, but there have been a lot of sixes. But we do seem to have the potential for even 7.5 magnitude earthquakes.
We're talking with Jim Zulweg, earthquake seismologist at Boise State University, and I'm John Gardner, filling in for President Bob Kustra. Let's talk a little bit about the swarm of earthquakes in the Cascade area in 2005. You were interviewed a lot by the media about that. First of all, swarm is a noun I've not heard used associated with earthquakes before. So tell us a little bit about what that word means, and then let's talk about the Cascade swarm.
A swarm of earthquakes is a sequence of earthquakes where you don't have a very clearly recognizable main shock. A lot of people are familiar with having a big earthquake and then having aftershocks, and sometimes you might have foreshocks as well. But in a swarm, the swarm activity usually is very difficult to say when it began, and it gradually just creeps up and gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and you have more and more and more earthquakes, and they get to a certain level, and then they gradually tail off. Reno right now, Reno, Nevada, is actually undergoing a swarm that's been going on since January and almost right under the city. So an earthquake swarm is something that doesn't have a clearly defined beginning end, and even the main shock is hard to tell because there may be three or four earthquakes all about the same size.
And so we experienced one of these in the Cascade region in 2005?
Yes, there was a strong swarm. It was the strongest swarm in western Idaho, probably in at least 40 years, that occurred in 2005. And it was an unusual swarm also. We typically don't have earthquakes in Idaho that are magnitude less than about 4 felt by people. These earthquakes were so shallow and they were occurring right under people's houses practically that we actually had somewhere between 200 and 500 of the Cascade earthquakes were being felt. I actually heard one that had a magnitude of minus 0.5, and a moment later somebody who was standing nearby felt a magnitude 0 earthquake. I mean, I was just amazed.
Did you learn anything unusual about the area as a result of these swarms?
Well, we certainly did. This swarm was a pretty remarkable swarm because it actually seems to have occurred on the Long Valley Fault, which is what actually causes West Mountain out west of Cascade. It was not known prior to that as being an active fault, although we had suspected it could be. But also, this earthquake caused ground breakage, which is very unusual for such small earthquakes. And so I've actually been able to dig open the fault trace and actually start to actually study what the fault looks like at the surface. This is the first time, because we didn't know what fault caused it. We didn't even know there was a fault in the immediate area. But what I did after locating the earthquakes, I extrapolated the earthquake pattern to the surface, went out looking, and lo and behold, there was a fault there. That kind of makes you, feel a little bit better about what you get taught.
So now that we know there's a fault there, does that make us think that there's a larger probability of earthquake activity in central and southern Idaho?
Yes, indeed. You can't. You have to have some proof that a fault is active before you can use it in earthquake hazard evaluations. And there's a certain level that's actually legalized that you actually have to meet certain criteria. And so, as a result of the 2005 swarm, we can actually include the Long Valley Fault as a fault that could potentially cause damage in western Idaho. The Long Valley Fault, if a magnitude 7 earthquake occurred on it, there would certainly be damage in Boise.
So that makes me think of some of the other development that's going on in the region. We've been hearing in the newspaper last year or so of people interested in building a nuclear power plant in the area, and earthquakes and nuclear power plants sound like a bad combination, and it's something that's always discussed. Is this something that concerns you? Is this part of the equation, or are they building those things well enough that we don't have to worry about it?
Well, there's two sides to the story. The first side of it is that the people who are interested in building nuclear power plants these days typically look for places where they think the seismic hazard is low. And they have a very good idea of how strong to build things in general. On the other hand, the people who are building this particular plant, the site they've picked is very close to what we think is the most active fault in the Boise region. And so just how that's going to enter into the equation. You can make a structure strong enough to withstand almost any earthquake, but it costs a lot of money to do it. And so then the question is going to be whether or not they are willing to spend the amount of money needed to actually bring this the structure into compliance, or whether it would be less expensive for them to build it in some other area.
And I'm assuming they would choose that site knowing that the faults are there based on things like access to water and electrical transmission, so that they're doing trade-offs as well. They're not purposely looking for that site, but they can't avoid it because of other constraints, you think?
Well, it's actually a little bit different situation. Certainly what you're saying is true, but the other problem is that we don't have a very good handle on where active faults are in Idaho at this point. We know that there's a lot of them, but the a number of studies that have actually been made to actually identify which faults are active, clearly active from geologic studies, and what their potential is, how long a period elapses between earthquakes, how big those earthquakes are, that is not well known in Idaho. And so the kind of information that they really need to make intelligent siting decisions is not available.
So turning our attention a little bit more to a little bit further from the Boise area, people who've driven east out of here on US 20 run across Craters of the Moon, which is obviously reminiscent of a lot of volcanic activity, not too far in the past. Is this still an active area? Is this also an area of concern for us?
Volcanic eruptions and potential earthquakes associated with them are an area of some concern, but the Craters of the Moon area is definitely what would be considered an active area. It has eruptions on the average roughly every couple thousand years, and the last eruptions at Craters of the Moon, of course, were about a couple thousand years ago. On the other hand... Yeah, maybe an hour or two. But anyway, the type of eruption that occurs at Craters of the Moon, though, it tends to be a fairly non-hazardous eruption. It's the same type of lava that you have in the Hawaiian volcanoes, and Hawaiian volcanoes typically put on great shows. It'd be great for tourism. But in terms of actually causing damage and loss of human life is quite rare. You can actually outwalk a lava flow in most cases. I have done so. So I didn't even have to break into a sweat or a run or anything like that. But that type of eruption certainly is possible. And it's even possible closer to us here in Boise, because if you look at places like High Prairie, or if you look at the canyon of the Boise River or some of the areas out around Micron, those lavas are relatively recent, geologically speaking. They're less than 200,000 years old. Some of them are less than 100,000 years old or in that neighborhood. It would be a mistake to say that we could not have an eruption in the Boise area even now, although certainly it seems to be getting less and less frequent.
Well, and that kind of leads me to thinking about the reports of the Yellowstone area. They say that's building to a major eruption sometime in geological time frame soon. What would be that impact of a major eruption there on us? Are we close enough or far enough that it doesn't matter?
It really depends on which way the wind is blowing, John. And I'm perfectly serious about that. If the wind is blowing to the northeast, as it usually does, the prevailing winds, it will blow most of the ash, which is going to be the big impact at distances more than a couple of hundred miles from the eruption. It'll blow that off to the northeast, off toward the Great Plains states, Montana and so forth. If it is blowing in our direction, It could be very serious. We could have a lot of casualties here and a lot of buildings down. We were likely to get, even if the wind is blowing in a favorable direction, we're still likely to get 2 or 3 feet of ash here at least. That's a livable amount. But if it's blowing in the other direction, we could get 30 feet of ash. And that much ash in the streets here would collapse all sorts of buildings, be a tremendously difficult health hazard, would be not be something that I would necessarily want to be experience close up.
So to put that in context, how much ash fell in the vicinity of Mount St. Helens? That wasn't nearly that much, right?
No, typically you very close to the mountain, you of course you had a lot of ash, but places like Yakima and Ellensburg, places where you saw in the news a lot, they usually had something in the range of 3 to 5 inches of ash. And even that much ash accumulation, if it gets wet, is enough to collapse building roofs. So, it's not very much, but it's more than just a nuisance at that point. Now, on the other hand, how likely is this eruption? Okay, well, once again, people have looked at the geology and they've said, well, Yellowstone has eruptions every 200 to 250,000 years. They go back, there's been three of these at intervals to 250,000 years. The last one was 200 to 250,000 years ago. So they say, oh, well, it's time. Well, that's not taking into account, though, the fact that the magma systems actually evolve with time. They change geochemically as well. We don't know that it is going to erupt in the same way once again. There is no proof of that. We still have to have a lot more information before we can actually say that it really is going to erupt. I'd say chances are that it's going to erupt again, but whether or not it'll form one of these super volcano mega disaster type things, I think that's a question that should be looked at a lot more carefully.
We're talking today with Jim Zollweg, earthquake seismologist at Boise State, and I'm John Gardner, filling in for President Bob Kustra. Let's turn our attention to some of the benefits of living in a geologically active area. We enjoy a very good geothermal resource here in Boise. Much of the downtown area is heated by that. Tell us about the relationship. Or what exactly causes the geothermal resource? Where is that coming from? Why does that occur?
Usually geothermal resources are in some way caused by warm water reaching the surface. As you go down into the earth, the temperature increases. Now, you don't have to have magma down there, but it helps. But the temperature naturally increases. And if you have faults or fractures along which that warm water can migrate from depth to closer to the surface, and you have some sort of aquifer in which to sort of store that water, you will have a geothermal resource. And we have no shortage in the Idaho area of fractures and faults that water can actually migrate toward the surface. And the question more seems whether or not we can concentrate these resources or not. As a result of the migration of the water, though, along the fractures, there's a very close relationship between earthquake activity and geothermal resources. And in many places, although not all, you can use earthquakes to actually locate geothermal resources.
Tell us a little bit about that. I hear you've had some experience doing that. So how do you use your earthquake measurements to find geothermal resources?
Apparently the energy of the hot water actually tends to cause swarms of small earthquakes, swarms once again. So one of the things we actually do look for is swarms, and they should be unusually shallow swarms of earthquakes. Typically earthquakes occur at depths of greater than about 3 to 5 miles. Typically at a geothermal resource, you'll see earthquakes happening at 1 to 2 miles, maybe even a little more than that. But you'll typically see them occurring in swarms, and these are a good indication that you may actually have geothermal water, warm water, driving what is causing these earthquakes. So when we prospect for these things, we look for a place that's favorable, and then we look and try and locate the earthquake swarms. And then by using extremely detailed location procedures that I've developed, we actually try to see what geologic structures they're occurring on and then extrapolate those to a point where we could actually drill them.
You use this technique when in Hawaii. Tell us about that.
Well, in Hawaii, there's an area called the Lower East Rift. It's no secret that there's warm water there because the fractures actually erupted in 1955 in a big volcanic eruption. But, of course, Hawaii is very wet. A lot of water gets down and travels along these rift zones. And so an area was found that actually seemed to be potentially good. So we put about a nine-station seismograph network out there, kept it it operating for a year and a half, very carefully located all the earthquakes, and then a company actually drilled, which is something we almost never get to see, drilled down to where I said, I think this is the best point. Well, it actually hit it within approximately 70 feet of where I said it was at a depth of 2 miles, and it presently is providing, that particular well is providing approximately half the electricity for the Big Island of Hawaii.
Wow. Sounds like your talents could be used in the oil industry.
Well, I don't know. Oil, there's no energy behind it, that actually drives the migration. Yeah.
So much of downtown Boise is heated with geothermal energy, the new Ada County Courthouse, the State House, a lot of the commercial buildings. Since there's a relationship between earthquakes and geothermal, what are the chances of an earthquake changing those rifts and fractures that the water migrates along and then disrupting our geothermal resource?
Actually, pretty good if it's a big enough earthquake. It's well known that earthquakes, even very distant earthquakes, can cause the groundwater table to change significantly. In the 1964 Alaskan earthquake, which is a magnitude 9.2 off Anchorage, the groundwater levels, as shown by wells, actually went up and down as much as 20 feet over the course of a few hours. In the Bora Peak earthquake in 1983 up near Challis, the groundwater table actually rose 6 or 7 feet. So there's the potential for disruption is quite good. The good part about news, though, is that usually after 6 to 7 years, it will recover.
So that disruption for groundwater isn't just geothermal, it's all the groundwater. So
yes, it's all the groundwater,
so
including geothermal.
Geothermal may be the least of our problems at that point.
Since this can happen a long way away from a big earthquake, it could be the only problem we have as a result of that earthquake.
So how well is Idaho being monitored for earthquakes? How many, you've established a network of seismographs around?
Well, we still have a few seismographs operating out in this area. The Idaho National Engineering Laboratory, INEEL, or whatever they're calling it these days.
No E's anymore.
Idaho National Laboratory, that's right. The Idaho National Laboratory has about 20 stations, and University of Idaho has a couple. By and large, the state is very much under-monitored for the kind of activity that we have. Our present network in the Boise area just has a couple of stations. And so although we're going to be reactivating a couple of more, the present situation is not even as good as it was 10 years ago.
So we talk about monitoring them, and yet we have a hard time predicting. It's not the same thing as knowing that they're coming. Why is it so difficult to predict an earthquake?
Earthquakes seem to be secretive and furtive about their intentions. Basically, we don't quite understand what drives earthquakes on a micro scale. You have a good idea on the macro scale what causes earthquakes, but on the micro scale, we don't. And the difficulty is that we do not know what signs to look for in most places. And what little bit of information that we have suggests that the signs that there's an impending earthquake occur only over very localized small areas. So you have to have an instrument in the right place at the right time. And you have to have somebody who isn't so jaded by saying, looking for these things for 20 or 30 years and not finding them, that they're still looking for them. I've predicted a couple of small earthquakes, but the amount of work it was compared to the value of having predicted a magnitude 3 earthquake doesn't seem to have been worth it, in my opinion. And frankly, I think that there's an awful lot of research that needs to be done to actually be able to understand how these. There may be earthquakes that simply cannot be predicted. That may be, that's the other possibility.
There's a lot of folklore about animals reacting before an earthquake comes. Is there any evidence that they're somehow picking up on things we don't measure?
I strongly believe that that is happening. The scientific studies have been very inconclusive, but mainly I think that's because they put all different types of animals into the same boat, into the same pool. I think that certain animals may react to changes in the magnetic field. There's clearly been changes in the magnetic field shown in the case of some earthquakes. My suspicion is that that's what some of the animals are actually picking up on. I don't think they're picking up on foreshocks or anything like that. There's been a lot of times where we saw that there were no foreshocks. So I think that there's something in the geoelectric or the geomagnetic field that's a variation that they're picking up on that they're very sensitive to. In 1975, snakes came out of their holes in the ground, out of hibernation, in 20 degree below zero weather because they were so disturbed, and there was an earthquake, a big earthquake, 2 days later.
Wow. Well, I'd love to keep talking on this issue, but we're out of time. Jim Zoellick, thank you for joining us on New Horizons.
Thank you for having me, John.
Next week, an interview with Steve Netto, statewide large carnivore coordinator at the Idaho Department of Fish and Game, talking about wolf management in Idaho. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, research provided by Kathleen Craven, and our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm John Gardner, filling in for Bob Custra. Please join us next week as we talk to the people who help shape our world in the Treasure Valley and beyond on New Horizons.